Back at it for you on Connecticut's Today, Thursday, July 23rd. Noted researcher and professor Dr. John Lott joined us in the 3 o'clock hour to talk about his 10th book, a new one again, regarding misconceptions around guns. Len Fasano, State Senate Republican leader, in the 4 o'clock hour on efforts to revamp policing in the state. Former Democratic State Rep. Chris Caruso from Bridgeport in the 5 o'clock hour talked about the latest behind the jostling over Bridgeport's Columbus statue. And State House Minority Leader Themis Claridis joined us just after 5:30 to give her thoughts on what may be happening or may not be happening with a police accountability bill.
As founded the Crime Prevention Research Center, you know him very well. He's been in several media outlets. He's held research or teaching positions at such highly valued institutions as Yale, the Wharton School of Business at University of Pennsylvania, the University of Chicago, Stanford University, Rice University. He has written 9 previous books. His new book is out, book number 10, Gun Control Myths, How Politicians, the Media, and Botched Studies, quote unquote, have twisted the facts on gun control. Dr. John Lott is the guest. John, Paul here on WICC. How are you today?
Oh, doing great. Thanks very much for having me on.
Well, John, I appreciate it. It's book number 10. Are you frustrated, John, writing these books that, you know, you still have to make these appearances and talk about this issue and write books like this? Does it frustrate you that a lot of myths and misinformation seems to be peddled out there about guns and gun violence?
Yeah, no, it's frustrating. I guess the most frustrating thing is that the level of kind of misstatements and misinformation seem to actually be growing over time rather than getting smaller. But, you know, I'm sure we can thank people like Michael Bloomberg and what have you for things like that.
Yeah, he is one of these guys, John, that really has taken, listen, he's free to do with his money, his billions, what he wants to, but he is one of these guys that seems to get the big spotlight, all the microphones when he does something or intentionally tries to do something about guns. But it frustrates me, John, because there's never any critical analysis, I find, of, you know, when Mr. Bloomberg or anyone else does things like this.
Right. Well, you know, it's an amazing double standard on a lot of this stuff. I mean, if the NRA were to go and spend hundreds of millions of dollars on research, I don't think the media would, you know, cover it at all. Mm-hmm. Bloomberg not only funds research with hundreds of millions of dollars, but he's set up something called the Trace, which writes articles that get rerun in places like NPR or Scientific American or other places as if they were, you know, the regular reporters for those places putting together the stories. And, you know, I just can't imagine them kind of just reprinting articles that the NRA had put out in those types of publications. And yet, you know, they go and they say, well, the Trace is an independent news organization, and they don't see, you know, Bloomberg as having any particular bias on this issue. You know, but they don't take any difference than any of his other gun control organizations like Everytown or Moms Demand Action or anything else. And, you know, the irony is that the Trace is regularly attacking, you know, politicians who get NRA donations, saying that they've been bought off, as if people can't honestly believe those things without getting paid. But, you know, you just contrast it. In the last election cycle, the NRA gave about $800,000 to congressional candidates across the country. Over that same 2 years, Bloomberg gave $110 million. So if he really believes just to congressional races, he apparently spent even more on state legislative races. And, you know, but there's no hint of, you know, kind of being ironic or anything else that they go and attack these other politicians for who have benefited from donations from the NRA as being bought off. And yet, you know, you're going to search in vain to see the trace or any of the places that they write their articles for criticizing Bloomberg for his spending.
John, for somebody who may be listening to us who is not familiar with your previous work and why you have skillfully looked at this train of thinking and the controversy over this in the U.S., what first drew you to this as a researcher, as a college professor, lecturer, and researcher into a critical look at what you say are many myths about gun control over the years? What drew you to that?
Right. Well, I had been chief economist at the U.S. Sentencing Commission, and I had written a lot of stuff on crime, but I'd never really been very interested at all in the gun issue. I was teaching a class on crime, mainly corporate and white-collar crime, at the Wharton Business School. And I made the mistake of telling the students that we were ahead in the syllabus. And I had a couple students come up to me after the class and say, well, you know, if you have the time and we're ahead in the syllabus, you know, and it's not exactly on topic, but we're dealing with crime-type issues, would you mind spending a little bit of a discussion on gun control? And I had read some of the academic work in the area, and it was pretty poorly done. And I just kind of assumed that there was other better work out there. But I figured, well, okay, I could do that. But if I'm going to do that, it's going to force me to kind of systematically look through the academic literature on it. And I was just stunned by how poorly done the existing work was. I mean, I could talk to you for hours about it. But, you know, there were small studies that none of them had even tried to account for the impact of law enforcement on crime rates, you know, just basic things that you would think anybody would have tried to deal with. And when you're an academic, you do papers for one of two reasons. Either you have a new idea, which was like 95% of the papers that I had done, or you think you could simply do a better job than other people had done. I started working on it, almost stopped about six different times because it just didn't interest me that much. And I finally finished a paper when I'd gotten to the University of Chicago. And I had gotten a call from a reporter named Dennis Cushon, who wrote for USA Today. Mm-hmm. Dennis had met me when I was chief economist at the U.S. Sentencing Commission. And he would call me up every 6 to 9 months or whatever when he had some question and ask me about it, and I would answer. And anyway, so he asked me his questions for the article that he was working on, and he said, oh, by the way, what are you working on? And I told him, he said, well, that sounds interesting. I asked if I could send him the paper, and I did.
Wow.
And about a week later, it was on the front page of USA Today.
Oops.
And, and we were kind of off to the races then. But there are basically two things, because normally I don't do more than a few papers in any area.
Yeah.
I was just, you know, the work was attacked a lot, and so partly I was defending it and explaining what was going on. But also, I've been involved in a lot of academic debates, and I've never seen so much misinformation out there on an issue as I have with guns. And I guess I kind of got convinced that if I didn't do battle on this, nobody would. And it basically cost me my academic career. When I was at the University of Chicago, my book, More Guns, Less Crime, came out in May of that 1998.
I remember that,
and
yeah.
And in November of 98, Mayor Daley called up the president of the University of Chicago and complained about me, basically spent 45 minutes going through all the wonderful things that the city was doing with the university. And then at the end of the conversation said that but Lott's continued presence at the university was going to do, quote-unquote, irreparable harm.
So in true Chicago style, he basically gave the university an ultimatum, is what you're saying.
Correct.
Wow.
And then I went to Yale.
I remember that, yeah.
And the second year I was at Yale, I was asked by the members of the state legislature in Hawaii to come out and testify on their changes that they were considering for licensing and registration of guns. I'm not a lobbyist. I only go when I'm invited by members of the committee that's hearing testimony to come in as an expert to mm-hmm. to go and testify. And I went out there, and I guess people blame me for killing the legislation that was there. And the two U.S. senators from Hawaii called up and complained to the dean of the law school at Yale about
was that Guido Calabresi at the time?
No, it was Tony.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Basically, there was no future then at Yale for me. And that's kind of the history of it. And
John, John, hang on for just a second. We have to take a break. I want to come back, John, and talk exactly about maybe two or three of the myths that you think are the worst ones. The name of the book, folks, Gun Control Myths, How Politicians, the Media, and Botched Studies Have Twisted the Facts on Gun Control. Dr. John Lott is the guest. John, hang on. First, traffic and weather together. 3:17 at WICC. His latest book, the 10th book he has written, Gun Control Myths, How Politicians, the Media, and Botched Studies Have Twisted the Facts on Gun Control. Dr. John Lott with us for a few more minutes. John, the remaining time we have, the myths. What are maybe the one or two biggest myths, John, that you see in your research that are still perpetrated out there about guns?
Right. Well, I mean, there's lots of them. I think the way the media handles mass public shootings has had a huge impact on the gun debate. You know, one of the things that is missed that I wish they would cover once in a while is where these attacks occur. 94% of these mass public shootings take place in areas where guns are banned. These killers may be crazy in some sense, but they're not stupid. They target areas where they know victims aren't going to be able to defend themselves. Their goal is to kill as many people as possible, and they know if they go to a place where people are defenseless, they're going to accomplish that. But you will look in vain to find media coverage that ever mentions that these guys have picked a target once again where victims are not allowed to be able to go and defend themselves. I think the debate would be different if even once in a while that was mentioned. The other thing is we have this impression that the United States is somehow unique in terms of having a lot of these mass public shootings. The media simply doesn't cover attacks in other countries. You know, if you look at it over the last 20 years, you find that the United States makes about 1% of the mass public shooters in the world, but we make up almost 5% of the world population. So we're way below the world average. If you look at fatality rates per capita, there are lots of countries in Europe, just major countries, for example, like France, Switzerland, Finland, Norway, Russia, that have much higher fatality rates from these mass public shootings than we do. France's rate is about 111% higher than the rate in the U.S. Russia's is over 50% higher than ours. You know, the worst, if you just compare Europe and the United States, the worst mass public shooting was in France in November 2015, where 130 people were killed. The second worst mass public shooting was in Norway, where if you ignore the bombing deaths, you had 67 people murdered and 110 others wounded. But the third thing that I think is misrepresented on that is just the media, what it covers and what it doesn't cover. Few people would know that there are literally dozens of cases in the last few years where what otherwise would have been mass public shootings were stopped by concealed carry permit holders. Just last week, there was a case in Indiana where a police chief said that she strongly believed that many people would have been killed if it wasn't for a concealed carry permit holder who was driving by when an attack started. His car was actually hit by one of the bullets that were being fired. He got out and used his gun to stop the attack.
I read that, yeah.
And, I mean, you see this all the time. in my book, I have one chapter where I've collected literally dozens of these stories. The thing is, if you look over the last 5 years, there's really only two cases that got any real national news coverage where somebody with the permit stopped the attack. And in both cases, the media completely botched the story. In one case, people remember the synagogue shooting in Pittsburgh.
Yes.
3 days after that, there was another attack at a Kroger grocery store in Louisville, Kentucky, where an attacker went into a grocery store, started shooting blacks, and what got the attention of the New York Times and Meet the Press and ABC, CBS, all the major broadcast networks was the statement by the murderer to a customer saying, "Whites don't shoot whites." And it was played as the murderer, who was white, was assuring a customer who was white that he had nothing to worry about because they were both whites, that he wasn't going to shoot him. Well, what they left out was the first part of the quote. If somebody had read the local news media there, they had the full quote. The full quote was, "Please don't shoot me. Whites don't shoot whites." So rather than assuring the customer that the customer wasn't going to get shot, the customer was a concealed carry permit holder and was pointing his gun at the murderer. And the murderer was begging the customer not to shoot the murderer. And in fact, they exchanged gunfire. The murderer was seriously wounded. He got in his car, was able to drive a mile away before he passed out, and the police picked him up when he was passed out in the car.
John Lott, we are up against it time-wise, but thank you. Yeah, I remember that. That's, you know, John, that's just journalistic malpractice. You know, I have a journalism degree and stuff like that. Drives me crazy. If folks,
I just was able to text at that time with Chuck Todd, who spent 5 minutes on the story.
Yeah.
I wrote him and said, you know, you missed this part. He blocked me at that point. He never corrected the story.
Now,
I sent him links to the local newspapers there.
It's sad, John. It really is. Dr. John Lott, Ph.D., his new book, The Tenth One, Gun Control Myths, How Politicians, the Media, and Botched Studies Have Twisted the Facts on Gun Control. John, thank you. I appreciate it. Thanks for the time. Hopefully we'll hook up down the road. Thank you, John.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Dr. John Lott there. And State Senate Leader Len Fasano is on the phone with us. Len, hi. How are you?
Good, Paul. How have you been?
I'm doing all right, Len. We have a lot going on, the police bill, all this COVID, and now this disagreement, and I guess you are giving voice to a concern here about what the Secretary of State's office can tell the town of Wallingford and individual towns and cities. What are your concerns here? And outline the situation for us.
So what happened is the Secretary of State has decided to order that town halls have mailboxes, lack of a better term, in which they can drop off their absentee ballots, which are fine. But the town of Wallingford, and I agree with Mayor Dickinson, believes that those ballots need to be secured, just like if you brought them into town hall. You can't leave them out. You got to secure them in a spot because they're a vote. They're a constitutional right. You got to protect them. So he has said he's going to put the box inside the town hall. So somebody walks in, puts the ballot inside the mailbox, and leaves. This way they're secured at night.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody can tamper with them. And that's his main concern. And I believe that to be an accurate concern. And I talked to the governor, I don't know, maybe back at the beginning of May or something about this issue when this was being discussed, that they shouldn't be outside where they could be damaged. They should be placed inside. Now, the Secretary of State says, oh, your choice between voting or getting sick. Let's be clear. People could mail them still. Doesn't stop that. They can mail them. Number two is wearing a mask and walking in and dropping off the ballot is a nominal risk of COVID, especially since we're less than 2.5% infection rate. You know, they go into stores. People go to stores all the time. Walk into town hall, put it in, leave. That's it. And now you know they're secured. And the Secretary of State is demanding the town of Wallingford putting it outside. And Mayor Dickinson basically said, I'm not. And I think that's a right move. And, you know, the Secretary of State, for her to make the issue she's making, in the 10 years that she's been Secretary of State, there has not been one statewide election that has not been fouled up under her leadership, whether it was closing polls early, whether it was temporarily closing polls, whether it was the machines not working, whether it was disabled people in certain towns weren't able to vote. We had ballots that had wrong names on them in Stratford and for Senator Logan out in Hamden. So for her to argue that she's the security of our election system, she has done nothing to either go after the people committed fraud. She's never made any corrections to that. And she hasn't run an election smoothly yet. And yet she's talking from this mighty tower. And what's amazing is when things go bad, she blames the register of voters, she blames the town clerk, she blames the computer systems. And when things go great, she's the first one out there saying it's all about me. And that's just got to change.
So what
she
is
can't
her
live behind a facade?
Len, what is her point that, and the people who are criticizing you on this and Wallingford for this, is the point is, is this disenfranchising people that they would have to go a few feet inside town hall, walk up the what, the 7 or 8 steps there in front of town hall and open the door and walk in? Are they saying that this ballot box should be outside 24/7? Is that their point?
Yeah, their point is that, yeah, it doesn't give people the opportunity to vote. You got to be kidding me. I mean, this is not the only way they can vote. They can put it in the mail. You get the absentee ballots that apparently applications she's mailing out at, at ridiculous, I think, manner. But and you fill it out and you get it. You can drop it off at town hall or you can mail it. So you mail it. If you can't mail it, you know, yeah, people work. You got 9 to 5 to drop it off. You could give it to a relative to drop off if you can't. So her argument to me is hollow. You know, the other thing is disenfranchised. You know, what people don't know is in Stratford, there was an election. And Republicans lost, and we lost a few votes in the House seat, right?
Yeah.
And it turned out that the election had a problem because the names did not appear of the candidate because the ballots were in error.
Yes, I've had Jim. I had Jim Feehan. I had Jim Feehan on the show twice on this. Yeah,
that's right.
And
do you think she would stand up and say voters have been disenfranchised because they were never given the opportunity to vote for a representative who represents their district? She has said not a word. The House Democrats were supposed to have a hearing to determine what they should do. 2 years later, they haven't had a hearing. She hasn't stood up, but let me tell you, if this had been a Republican legislator and a Democratic state rep, and she was Secretary of State, she would have been all over this saying, this is wrong, you're disenfranchising, we need to correct this. She plays politics from her role. It is what it is, Paul, and I'm going to say it. She plays politics from her role. People who were arrested in Bridgeport, she never stopped and said we should change the system. Never stopped and said we should change the system. Investigations, New Haven, Waterbury, Hartford. She's not, I mean Waterbury, I meant to say New Haven, Bridgeport, Hartford. She never stopped and said we should change the system. What is going on here?
And Len, before before the primaries last time around, if I remember correctly, the League of Women Voters or somebody, Len, if you remember several months ago, they went to her beforehand and said, you know, please have observers be on the lookout because something is going to happen. And I think she or her staff said, well, there has to be a complaint first. Well, sure enough, we know what happened in Bridgeport on primary night and nothing came of it, right?
Well, Paul, let me one up you on that one. So 3,000 signatures came in saying, if you're going to do this absentee, 3,000 signatures from Bridgeport said, please put a moderator in Bridgeport.
Yeah.
Please. That's now. this second, this moment. And nothing from her. You don't read about it. You don't hear about it. Nothing disenfranchises a voter more than a voter believes their vote doesn't count. As soon as you believe your vote doesn't count, you've completely disenfranchised that voter. And Marilyn Moore, who's the current state senator who ran against Ganim, she stood up, African-American woman, Democrat, and said there is a lot of fraud and absentee. Not a Republican, not a Trump, which is their favorite tune to play, but an African-American woman who said, my voters are disenfranchised because there's fraud with absentee. You should look at it. Nothing.
Yeah, yeah. Len, hang on. I want to come back to you in a couple of minutes. Take a break here. I want to talk about what's going on right now at the state capitol, what happens next week when the Senate gets its hands on a couple of bills here. Len Fasano, the guest, for a few more minutes. First, traffic and weather together right here. 4:16 on a Thursday on WICC. Couple more minutes with Len Fasano, state Senate minority leader on the Republican side. Len, a lot of jousting going on right now on the House side. You folks in the Senate are going to get bills next week, I believe, on absentee ballots and also on the police reform. Let's talk about the police reform thing. From what I read, Len, and obviously from what you're hearing, I guess, it's a little squishy for the House Democrats on this elimination of qualified immunity. And I know even in your chamber, there were several stories, Len, and all the papers that even some of the Democrats you work with are not really on board with this yet.
Yes, I think that, you know, let me tell you, it's really sad. And this is what is really bad. Right now, they're doing four bills in the House. They started a little bit after 11. They're doing four bills in the House.
Yeah.
I just saw some reference that's going to go till tomorrow morning, midday.
Jeez.
But at any rate, literally as we're talking, the bill is being changed, and not slightly. A lot of significant changes last night. I will give the chairs credit that they made some changes over the past few days to take into account some of our concerns. That's very nice, and they've been working with us. But there's been other changes we haven't been consulted on that, not that we have to, they're a minority party, but in spirit of cooperativeness, you think you would. But relative to the immunity for police officers that they want to take away, there's been four or five different versions. That's a big issue. That's really yeah. What's making this bill. And there's been four or five changes in the last 3 hours. Well, what's the rush?
Yeah.
Can we stop, get it done, have the public have a right to look at it on a critical issue? Critical issue. And then bring us back in.
You know, Len, on an issue, if I can just say here, on an issue that may, depending upon what they do or what you folks do, may decide, Len, or may cause men and women to decide, well, I want to be a police officer in Connecticut, or hell no, I'll go somewhere else to be a police officer.
Exactly. Look, there was a... we were on a phone call with a bunch of police officers, a group of them, the other day, a week ago, I think it was today. And I was talking to him. There was a police officer, African-American, been on the force for 5 years in New Haven. And he said, you know what? I love being a policeman. I thought this was going to be my career, but I'm not putting my family at risk. I am leaving the force, and I'm leaving everything behind. Mm. I'm not, you know, I'm going to give it all up, and I'm going to do something else. Because I cannot afford to put my family at risk. That is sad.
Yeah, and with the whole insurance thing. And Len, finally, I know one of the issues, too, is absentee ballots. We were just talking about that. And you and I have talked about this before. You know, you and I thought that adding an exception to use an absentee ballot, I thought that had to go through the state constitution. I guess it doesn't. I don't know. You're the lawyer. I'm not. I'm a little confused about all this.
So, yes, there was an argument that illness in the constitution, does that include COVID? And the argument went back and forth. A court has initially ruled just yesterday or the day before that illness does include COVID for the purpose. So there's been initial ruling that's going to go to the Supreme Court. I think that most people and Republicans believe that because of COVID, although Democrats want to change the narrative, Republicans believe that because of COVID, we should allow people to vote absentee. They should call the town clerk's office and get a ballot. What I don't think it should be happening is the Secretary of State mailing out absentee ballots, having no idea where these ballots are going, no recordation of these ballots, I should say applications for an absentee ballot, no idea where these applications are going. They're going to people who never lived in a residence. They're going to people who haven't voted in 6 to 10 years and may not be at the residence. Just going out. That is going to cause a problem. We have elections that are won by 2 votes, 3 votes, 1 vote, mm-hmm. 6 votes. That could change an election. So I have a problem with that. She had 100,000 returned already. That doesn't include independents that are going to be on this go-around and unaffiliates. So we're all okay with people having access to the ballot box by absentee because they're afraid of COVID. But we're not okay with her blindly mailing out applications. That is not a good thing.
All right, Len, thanks. We appreciate it, and we'll talk to you in the next few days to see what shakes out in your chamber. Len, appreciate it. Thanks.
Thank you, Paul.
Yep, Republican State Senate leader, the outgoing State Senate leader, Len Fasano. Perhaps for a Columbus update. Chris, what's going on with you today?
Hey, Paul, how are you doing?
Good, what's up?
I'm just having dinner at Avukella restaurant in Bridgeport downtown, outdoor, and it's beautiful out, as a matter of fact.
Nice,
hey,
nice.
I just got a call from one of the city council members who put the resolution in to have the mayor put the statue back up of Columbus.
Mm-hmm.
And the city's attorney's office was just presented with a writ demanding that the mayor call the council into session or that they'll be proceeding with court action against the mayor and the city.
Okay, so you're saying that a city council member has just presented the city with a legal action or a request that the statue go up with now a formal threat of legal action.
That's right. And I guess in the form, I'm not an attorney, but my understanding it's a writ, WRIT, that served on the mayor, you know, calling on him to call the meeting of the council, which he was supposed to do under the charter, with a certain time period. And if he doesn't, then he'll be taken into court, and the action will be to have the court order the mayor to enforce the provision of the city charter.
Well, this certainly, Chris, does make another chess move here. How do you think the mayor might respond?
Well, so far he's been pretty obstinate that he will not call a meeting. He's trying to shift everything into the park board. You know, the group, frankly, under the charter that was the legal authority that had the right to take the statue down or not. So he's trying to shift it over to them. And I think, frankly, the council's had enough. You know, they're a separate but equal part of government in Bridgeport. They're a legislative body, and they want their request to hold a meeting that's allowed under the charter. The mayor has to officially call the meeting.
Mm-hmm.
They want the mayor to honor that part of the charter and allow the council to meet and discuss the issue. I think the mayor is trying to get out from under it by going to the park board. And frankly, you know, it just underscores, you know, the concerns and anger out there that exist. That, you know, I think when the statue came down, I think the mayor thought everything was going to go away and there wouldn't be an issue. But frankly, the issue continues. I think it's the way it was done to the Italian-American community. As I mentioned to you, Paul, we feel disrespected and humiliated by the action that the mayor took. We were asked to meet about the statue. We did that in good faith. We sat down. We had an agreement, and the mayor pulled the plug and never told us about it. We learned about it when we drove down to the park and saw the statue, you know, being lifted off of the pedestal down there. So I think, it's moving in that direction. I know one of your callers suggested about putting the statue in the St. Margaret Shrine on Park Avenue. And I was talking to one of their trustees, and I don't think they would do it because I think they're fearful that people would go in and try to, you know, destroy the statue,
yeah.
And then that in turn could affect all of their other statues they have, you know, to saints and the Blessed Mother and so forth. I know down in Boston, apparently an anarchist group burnt the statue to the Blessed Mother in Boston, you know, and there's in New Haven, there was a church that was, you know, red paint was put on the doors and satanic, you know, remarks and all, you know.
Yeah, which, so, of course, Chris, yeah, nothing says racial harmony like painting satanic symbols on a church and burning plastic flowers in the statue of the Blessed Mother. That's
right.
that's your concoction for everybody to be peaceful and happy, isn't it? Jeez.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, and I think they've got to be careful because when you start going after the symbols of the Catholic Church, you're widening the audience of opposition at that point because you know everyone. There are a lot of people that worship the Blessed Mother, like myself, and so now it takes on a whole different level, and it widens the audience of people that are going to start fighting back, and I think that's what's happening with Columbus. You know, I think Italians throughout the state, from what I understand, I've been talking to some groups, they are organizing throughout the state. There's a lawsuit brought against the mayor of New Haven for taking down the Columbus statue, and it's based on discriminatory action against Italians, that no other statue was taken down other than the one that was erected by Italian Americans, you know?
Yeah.
So I think it's fair to say, Paul, the Italian American community throughout this state are fighting back, and those pandering politicians better remember one thing. The largest block of ethnic votes in this state are Italians. There's close to 20%. There's over 600,000 voters that affiliate themselves as Italian Americans.
Yep.
So, and I think people are, you know, frankly organizing now and are angry and they're just not going to be pushed around anymore.
Interesting. Chris, we will keep an eye on this. Thanks for the update. Chris, be good. Take care. And we'll talk to you. Thanks.
Take care, Paul.
All right. Former state representative Chris Caruso there, representative of the representative, one of them anyway, of the Italian-American community in Bridgeport, the general area. So the city council not backing down on this, serving a writ to the city, to the mayor, demanding that he call the meeting of the city council or get some sort of action underway here to come to some sort of decision on the Columbus statue, which, again, is a statue. I think everybody understands that. It is, in and of itself, it is an inanimate object. State House Republican leader Themis Claridis takes a couple of minutes out to join us. Well, Themis, from what I've been able to read and hear, this is kind of an ongoing thing all day. Give us an update. What do you have for us?
Hey, Paul. Well, it's 5:30 now, and we still haven't seen a version of the police accountability bill to vote on. There's been several versions in the past several weeks while negotiations have gone on in a bipartisan fashion. But the past 2 days, kind of things have broken down. And there is, as you mentioned, the big controversy is getting rid of qualified immunity for police officers. That's the main issue, yet there's other issues that are involved in the bill that still have questions. But for right now, we don't even have a bill to look at, let alone vote on.
Yeah, Themba, some of the outlets, the Connecticut Post, the Hartford Courant, you probably saw that they were reporting during the day that, you know, this thing is kind of getting tweaked on the fly or rewriting this, tweaking that. What are your thoughts on that? It sounds like this is trying to be rushed when maybe it doesn't have to be.
Right. I mean, I've been doing this a long time, and I know when things happen like this, when they get tweaked on the fly, as you said, it's because they're trying to make certain people happy or certain groups of people happy. And the result of that is never a good bill. It's never a good bill for the state. It's never a good bill for the parties that are interested in it on both sides. We asked for this particular qualified immunity issue to be given to the Police Accountability Task Force that we started last year that has met several times in the past month or two, that has police officers, that has African-American pastors, that has union people, that has everybody from, you know, all walks of life that may have an interest in the bill on there. They should be taking this up, and it should be thoroughly researched, because the issue of police accountability on both sides is very, very serious. I think we can all agree to that. We know that there are wonderful police officers, and the majority of them put their lives on the line for us every day, but there's also some issues with their accountability and their training, et cetera. And so we want to make sure that everybody is always treated fairly, regardless of the color of your skin or your religion or your orientation. So there's very important issues on both sides. So they should take the time, the next 6 months, study that in the task force and report it back to the legislature in January. So then they can decide what we should do going forward in a thoughtful manner. Rushing legislation always ends up with bad laws.
Is this being rushed by the other side because of the impending elections?
I don't know necessarily if that's what it is. I know the George Floyd tragedy in Minnesota certainly brought this to the fore. Oh, that's the vote.
Do you have to go to vote?
Sorry.
Do you have to go?
No, I'm okay.
Okay.
I'm okay now. That's just awfully loud.
I don't want to keep you from anything you have to do.
No, I mean, it's that brought this to the fore, and there were people that demanded we do something now. And again, this is very serious, and I think we do need to do something. But to do something in a short period of time, I've done this enough years to know when you rush very important matters like this, you don't end up with the best legislation and the best laws for all sides involved.
All right, Themis, thanks. We'll be in touch. Stay safe, and we'll talk in the next couple of days. Thanks. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Paul.
Thanks, Themis. State House Republican leader Themis Claridis of Derby.